Pleasure to introduce my own colleague, Barton Spivak, whose topic is vacuum string field theory and sliver state.
Indeed, that is the title of the talk. Thanks to the organizers for such a nice conference and for inviting me to speak. So over the last few years, the conjectures about what the tachyon of the open string is supposed to do have suggested lots of work, and in that work, the physical role of the tachyon has been understood better. And what is also nice is that some of the tools that we need in string theory have been developed as well. It certainly would seem that it's not an exaggeration to say that it's very likely that string field theory appears to give a correct, non-perturbative description of the phenomenon of tachyon condensation. The evidence has been quite nice over the last year. That is not quite the same as saying that string field theory is a full definition of non-perturbative string theory, but at least that set of non-perturbative issues related to classical open string field theory seems to work extremely nice. So I would think that developing more string field theory would be a good way to learn more about the tachyon and about the eventual description of string theory. Now, people have always asked in string field theory about the background dependence or background independence of the theory, and a lot of the criticisms and discussions have gone around this question. So certainly there seem to be like two major possibilities. You either do not choose a background or you choose a background to write string field theory. So if you do not choose a background, ideally that sounds like the best thing to do. You work in the space of all backgrounds, some of which need not be classical solutions, and that indeed there's an approach to string field theory of that form called boundary string field theory. And it has been developed to some degree, but not completely so far. On the other hand, you can choose a background, and that's the way the first formulations were done. Open string field theory of Witten in 86 is formulated by choosing some background using the BRST operator of that background, and of course the first time it was written it referred to the D25, and in many ways that's a canonical choice. But certainly here you could choose any other D-brain background, so any D-brain background allows you to write the theory. Now, if you have to choose a background, perhaps a better choice is using the tachyon vacuum, because at least in the bosonic string theory, it is the unique endpoint of all processes of decays of the unstable D-brains of this theory. So it's a very canonical choice. So there's of course more exotic possibilities, it's possible that maybe you can formulate string field theory with infinite number of D-brains, or perhaps a purely cubic formulation that was studied many years ago someday might be understood. In this talk, I will just focus on what we call, for lack of a better name, vacuum string field theory, which will refer to just trying to formulate the string field theory using the vacuum of the tachyon. So this subject matter was developed together with Leonardo Rastelli, with Ashok Sen, and there's these papers. There's related work that overlaps with some of our work by David Gross and Wadi Taylor, and that will be presented tomorrow by Gross. There's relevant earlier works that turned out to be useful by Rastelli and myself and Kostelecki and Potting, and interesting recent works related to the subjects by David and Matsuo. So this talk will basically deal with the structure of this kind of string field theory and the sliver state, which is a surprising state that arose in this context. Half strings and projectors will play a role, and I will skim through the representation of solutions representing many D-brains. So later this afternoon, Ashok Sen will discuss a more geometrical, perhaps, method to discuss general D-brain solutions, and he will use some of the pictures that I will introduce this morning, so it might be useful that a few points be clear in this talk so that you can follow Ashok's talk more easily. So let's just get started, and here is the action that was proposed for formulating vacuum string field theory. You see there, it looks very much like standard cubic open string field action. The only thing is that the Q that appears there is a little curly and doesn't have a subscript B for BRST. That's the difference at this moment. And well, that's a pretty important difference. We'll say that, in fact, in this case, as opposed to the standard BRST operator that involves the stress tensor of the matter conformal field theory, this Q should be an operator that must be of Gauss number one, but it's built only using the reparametrization Gausses. If this action is supposed to be gauge invariant, these three properties should hold. And that's really all you need for gauge invariance. And finally, given one of the conjectures about the Takian behavior, that once you roll down to the bottom of the potential that represents the vacuum, you're supposed to have no perturbative conventional open string states, we suggested that Q should have vanishing cohomology. Well, at this stage, you could ask many things, and I'll go through some of the obvious questions raised by this action now before trying to explain how we calculate with this action. Some of these questions have to do with long-standing questions about string field theory, and perhaps the answers will be a little short and perfect. Anyway, what is phi? You could ask, well, you're in a place where you don't have the D-brain and you don't have a conformal field theory. What do you have there? What is really phi? The string field in this case. Well, in general, what we will think here is that we choose a conformal field theory in the bulk representing a closed string theory background. On that closed string theory background, there are many possible D-brains that could exist there classically. And we'll choose one of them, any single one of them, an arbitrary one, and we'll call it BCFT0, a reference open string background. And simply, we'll use the string field, will be a Gauss number one state of that arbitrarily chosen background reference conformal field theory. Well, you would say immediately, well, you chose a conformal field theory. Aren't you really describing that D-brain to begin with? You're using that state space? No, you're really not describing that D-brain because you have a Q that has no cohomology. So if you study the spectrum of the action you've written, even though it seems to use the state space of any particular D-brain, it just has no state. So we would claim that the choice of this BCFT0 really does not matter. Well, you can ask, well, is that something you can check or you can't check? Well, this studies of background independence in open string field theory long time ago, and since Q doesn't know about the matter theory, the Gauss theory is supposed to be universal, and the BPZ inner product that enters in getting numbers in the action, as well as the string vertex, which is a full overlap, don't seem to depend at least explicitly on the choice of background conformal field theory. So that's referred as saying that this is formally open string background independent. If you take small, this formal statement has a more precise formulation in the case where you consider formulating the theory around two backgrounds that are connected by a small marginal deformation. In that case, there's a language, a precise language to deal with this. And in the space of boundary conformal field theories, there is a covariant derivative for states. And this is a picture that is going to come later several times. We think of states as things, sometimes surface states more precisely, as things associated with disks with a puncture and a local coordinate around them. And they basically say that if you, say, put a local operator over here, a ket, to get a number, that number is the correlation function of the local operator inserted on that point. Well, such states, as you know from perturbation theory of conformal field theories, if you try to modify the correlator by adding an interaction at the boundary, perturbatively you can just insert it over the part of the boundary that is outside the local coordinate disk, and that's what you should do. So if this is a covariant derivative, that you should integrate the marginal operator around the surface minus the disk, and only on the boundary, with such a connection, the covariant derivative of a three-string vertex is zero because the local coordinates eat up the whole disk. There's no part of the boundary of the disk that is not inside a local coordinate. The red regions of the previous transparency have gone to zero, essentially. In addition, the covariant derivative of the BRST operator, the conformal field theory is perturbed by adding a matter operator. This covariant derivative of a purely ghost operator doesn't change. And as a consequence of all this, at the end of the day, the covariant derivative in the space of theories of the action is zero. This is a statement essentially of manifest background independence. Let me just parenthetically, in smaller type, compare with what happened in the conventional cubic string field theory. One finds that the covariant derivative of the action is something that is non-zero, and that something for background independence must be written as the anti-bracket of S with a generator, and this generates the string field shift necessary to change the background. So whenever you have that the covariant derivative of the action is zero, you don't need to do a shift of the string field. At most, you're doing a homogeneous rotation of the string field generated by the connection. So in some sense, this is the intuition we have that choosing different conformal field theories to represent the vacuum really doesn't correspond to shifts of the string field or different backgrounds. They're just related by rotations with each other. A much more subtle question is the issue of closed string background dependence, and I will come back to it later. Now, does the choice of Q matter? Apparently, it does matter. Certainly, the simplest possibility would have been to set Q equals zero, and that gives you back the purely cubic string field theory that was considered a long time ago. And that is difficult to work with. Someday, maybe, it will be understood, but for the time being, we don't know how to work with it. The next simplest choice is Q equal to C0. The zero mode of the ghost field. It's a little surprising that such a simple thing works, but it does. It's C0 is conserved on the vertex. That means that C0 is a derivation of the star product, and that's pretty much all you need, apart from it squaring to zero, and having no cohomology, both of which are true. Well, the fact of the matter is that those C0 is not the only solution, and in fact, linear combinations of ghost oscillators of this form is the most general solution for gauge invariants. So the most general choice is that one, a linear superposition with arbitrary coefficients of these modes of the ghost field. This Cn, curly Cn over there, is a little Cn plus, with a sine factor, C sub minus n. Now, most likely field redefinitions relate many of them. I should mention that this kind of actions with purely ghost cues were obtained also many years ago as solutions of that purely cubic formulation of string field theory. Now, one way to decide which is the precise choice of Q might be to ask what it does to the identity string field. The identity string field is a string field that satisfies this with a star algebra, and there's a construction of it in terms of Virasoro operators and a very nice form found a few weeks ago by a group of students at MIT that just uses L minus 2, L minus 4, L minus 8, L minus 16, and something like that. It's a very surprising simple form. In conventional cubic open string field theory, when it was first written, the BRST operator annihilates the identity in what are back to the left. I'm sorry, that's the only thing I don't know how to represent. So you put the L minus 2, L minus 4, L minus 8, L minus 16 in that direction. It's a rather remarkable formula. We don't know any fundamental use of that formula, but it's still very surprising. So in conventional open string field theory, Q annihilates the identity, and this is not really necessary for gauge invariants of the action. As I mentioned, basically you need to be able to move the Q from the two sides in the inner product, and that's really all you need. But you could say, well, maybe life simplifies if the operator annihilates the identity, and certainly there are examples where it doesn't, and there are examples where it does. So there's certainly at least two classes of kinetic operators that are possible. And at present, I think it's not completely clear which one is the right class. Nevertheless, let us say, in general, before we pass to another subject, there were very nice results presented in David Fest's a few months ago by Wadi Taylor, in which there was quite some evidence that there are no perturbative excitations around the vacuum of the tachyon, and further results by this group of students having to do with the fact that the identity string field is trivial, that suggests that it's quite reasonable that there's really no cohomology down at the bottom, and therefore the operators that we've proposed here seem to be the simplest candidates with no cohomology and gauge invariants. In fact, I don't think we know of any other candidate with no cohomology and gauge invariants except field redefinitions of those. So since gauge invariants apparently cannot decide which class of Q is the right one, there's a minor possibility that all Qs are possible and just the redefinitions are a little more complicated. At least the most natural approach seems to be that we should try to understand Dibrain solutions in the string field theory, and the existence of regular solutions would constrain the form of Q. Well, this action is particularly nice and simple because it satisfies a factorization property. The field equations of the theory that are written in this form, if you attempt to factorize a string field into a product of a factor that depends on the ghost and one on the matter, the equation of motion immediately says that Q just knows about the ghosts, so it gets together with the ghosts, and the star product also factorizes, so you get two equations that you need to satisfy. And the equation in the ghost sector is a little complicated, but the equation in the matter sector is the equation of a projector. So that is quite nice, and that was not possible in the conventional theory with the BRST operator. With the BRST operator, it doesn't factor between them. The equation just cannot be simplified beyond this form. And the equation of the projector, even though we really didn't know solutions for this equation some time ago, now they're known. And still, solutions of this equation are much harder to find, and that's because there's just some simple operator here that just is not anymore a projector equation. And that maybe David Gross will say a lot tomorrow. Now, if you have a solution, the action evaluated at the solution, the cubic term and the quadratic term are essentially proportional, so you can just evaluate the quadratic term with some coefficient here, and you would have a factor having to do with the ghost and a factor having to do with the matter. And if the ghost factor is the same for every solution of the string field action, that will be an assumption. Different D-brains, we will say that they all have the same ghost factor as the common factor. We'll say it's universal. And therefore, the action is a constant times this BPZ inner product of the matter part. So whenever you will compute the ratio of tensions, for example, of brains, you need to evaluate the action, and the ratio of tensions will reduce to the ratio of the BPZ inner products of the matter solutions. Well, not the same more. So we have to solve, therefore, a projector equation. That is the main thing that has to be solved. A projector equation just in the matter sector. In the ghost sector is different. So that doesn't sound at first sight like terribly natural. Therefore, you could ask yourselves, can I find projectors, period? Projectors, say, that work both with matter and the ghost. Well, in string field theory, such projectors would have to happen at ghost number zero, because the star product adds ghost number, at least in the convention that the vacuum is at ghost number zero, the SL2R vacuum. So it has to be a field of ghost number zero, and it has to multiply to itself. Now, we didn't know of such fields as of 1 year ago, and this is the story of the so-called sliver that I'm going to speak about for a little while. So the sliver state will be introduced, and again the picture will be that to specify a state in general, you just need to give a disk, one puncture, and a local coordinate that is pictured here on this puncture. This is a local coordinate because if you want to ask what is the coordinate of Q, you use this map that throws a local coordinate in here, and you see this point, and that's the value of Xi is the local coordinate. This, associated to this picture, there is a state called sigma, and the definition of the state is that the inner product of sigma with the state phi of the conformal field theory, this is a number, is nothing else but the correlator that you obtain when you insert phi at the puncture using the local coordinate here. The local coordinate u over here is s of xi. So you basically take the operator that is here and you conformally map it into here and then compute the correlator. And that is this number that defines the state. It's actually a very concrete definition. Now, we'll use several pictures to define the states. Again, here is the local coordinate. And here is a disk, and you see the image of the local coordinate. So you sometimes work with the disk, you sometimes work in the upper half plane, and you sometimes work in another form in which this local coordinate has been put into this form. It's sort of turned a little bit around so that the puncture is at the end of this on the curved side rather than on the flat side. There's a standard map to do that. And then the rest of the surface is mapped accordingly, and it might turn out to have a very funny shape. I want you to remember this as the W hat coordinate, which is good or easiest to understand star products with. So the local coordinate takes this form and it goes like that. So there's a class of states that are defined in the following way. Again, remember, what was a state? A surface and a local coordinate pictured on it. So here it is, the state is really here. Here is this disk, and the local coordinate is this wedge over here. How do you put this wedge in here? Well, with this sequence of maps. You first turn it from this to that, and then you do a power transformation, and it ends up like this. Then you can map it even to the upper half plane, if you wish. And the angle here was chosen to be 2 pi over n, where n is an integer. And this is a peculiar kind of state. You can map it to the upper half plane, it looks like this. And at the end of the day, this Zn coordinate depends on psi. If you track the conformal maps as a tan of a factor and tan inverse of psi, and this you can call a function fn of psi. So this state, this sort of wedge state of number n, is nothing else than computing the correlators of is obtained by this definition. This number is the correlator of the vertex operator inserted through this map over here with the function fn over here. So at this moment, there's two particular values of n that are important and should not be confused. The case n equal 1, remember the angle over there was 2 pi over n. So n equal 1, the local coordinate eats up the whole disk, is here. And there's a little piece left, there should be a line here. And this is the field that is called identity, the string field identity. On the other hand, the other limit is n going to infinity, in which the local coordinate now becomes a tiny, thin, that's why we call it sliver, over here. And the sliver is therefore the state obtained in the limit when n goes to infinity. So they're the opposite sides of the world in some sense. Now, many times people think of a state, as I mentioned, you have a disk and a local coordinate and the rest. Many people think of the state more like in terms of the rest. And in that case, the sliver is not quite a thin sliver. The state would be the whole thing. And in the case of the identity, what is left is a sliver. But anyway, we thought of it this way first, so we called the sliver. And maybe it will be even more confusing to change now. So, in this picture here, once. The disk is really covered once. The local coordinate has been turned into a very thin thing. So, therefore, let's see what happens, or let's see what happens in what we call, remember the W hat coordinate that I mentioned a little time ago, and the local coordinate should look like a half disk. So how would the sliver look if I would have this local coordinate blown up to be a half disk? Well, if you blow up this to have a half disk, then the rest will be extremely big. It will be an infinite helix. So the picture of the sliver with regular coordinates is that here is the local coordinate patch, and this part is attached to A, M here, MB over here, and you have the rest of the thing that has gone on many, many turns, infinite number of turns. So it's a sort of a wedge of infinite angle over here. Notice that in this description of states, the AM would be called the left half of the string, and MB would be the right half of the string. While in the identity state, the left and the right half of the strings are essentially coinciding, on the sliver, they are as far as possible from each other. There's an infinite number of turns you have to do to go from the left side of the string to the right side of the string. Now, you could say, well, this is a singular state, maybe this is just not well defined. On the other hand, we know that correlators are invariant under SL2R transformations, so you can resolve some singular coordinates on punctures with SL2R transformations. In particular, if you have a correlator, you can compose the correlator with an SL2R transformation and it doesn't change. So remember, we define the wedge with n as a correlator with this function fn before. I should remind you, it is this function here, 2 over n tangent minus 1. So you could certainly take this correlator and compose with a SL2R transformation Rn. So what should you compose with? It's relatively clear. You sort of have to amplify the local coordinate all the time. And therefore, you compose with n over 2, and now you can take the limit as n goes to infinity. That is something you do to reassure yourself. It's nothing you really have to do, because the correlators are conformal invariant. But if you do it this way, you see that you get a finite limit, and therefore you have a regular description of the sliver, in which, finally, the sliver could also be viewed not just as an infinite helix, but as the upper half plane, where the local coordinate looks just like the Teichmuller region. So it's just another presentation. This is a presentation that will be used a lot by Ashok this afternoon. So it is a limit, essentially, of this one. As this size, as n goes to infinity, this size sort of goes to zero, and this point goes to infinity, and you blow it up, and you get the result that I mentioned. Yeah. No, there's no ghost whatsoever in this sliver yet. No, I'm working on the full sliver, but it will be a state of ghost number zero. So it's a pure surface state. So this projector is at ghost number zero. That's the only projectors that exist. But it's not quite a solution of the full string field equation, because that has to be at ghost number one, and you're missing a ghost factor. So there's nothing yet inserted on this picture, except the local operator that you measure the state at the puncture. Just for fun, you can map this upper half plane back to this picture, to the disk, and in this case, you might recall that the sliver was born as a picture of this kind, with this thing just very thin over here. Well, the effect of this resolution is to sort of, you should make this point regular, so you open it up, but as you open it up, this point sort of pinches to the other side. So in some sense, the left side of the string and the right side of the string factor and separate. How am I doing with time, though? Okay, it's not much, but anyway. let me present a regulated version of the sliver that will be important in the discussion this afternoon. We don't need actually this part. Just as you had the helix, remember the helix was built with a local coordinate that was a half disk, and then you had a thing that was going on many turns. If you had the state n, it goes out actually n minus 1 half turns, and a total number of turns. If you represent this, you turn this finite helix via a logarithmic map, you can take it into this representation of the sliver, in which a finite n sliver, you have the Teichmuller region for the local coordinate, and you have the rest of the sliver over here. In this representation, it will be easy to do certain star products. Now, I introduced this state now, but I didn't say why it would be a projector at all. Let me remind you how star multiplication works. Whenever you have a state that is presented of this form, with a local coordinate being a half disk, and the rest of the surface like this, and another state here, in this presentation, it is simplest to do the star product. You simply take the first surface and glue the right string, the right half of the string, MB, to the left half of this string over here, A prime, M prime. So this is the left and right. When you want to decide what is left and right, essentially, you can look from the inside of the surface out, and this is left and right. And this is the usual gluing of the right half of the right half of the first string with the left half of the second, therefore you form this surface over here. So multiplying surfaces presented in this way is very simple. Therefore, if you present the surfaces, now forget the local coordinates, this is the rest of the surface, and you present the surface with as a sector of angle alpha and a sector of angle beta, the star multiplication says glue this right string to this left string, so the sectors are put together, and the total angle is this one. Therefore, if you present the states that way, R alpha times R beta is R alpha plus beta, and moreover, R0 times R0, when the angle is 0, is 0, but there's just one extra case, which is the sliver, that infinite angle and infinite angle give you infinite angle, and therefore the sliver state will multiply to itself. Now, this sliver state is a ghost number 0, it has matter and ghost, but it really multiplies to itself on the nose. There's no extra factors, there's no divergences, nothing. It should just multiply to it, and we're pretty sure it does. The problems, or the delicate things, begin when you have to split the two of them. Now, this story maybe, I wanted to say something algebraic about this sliver. I'll go very fast through it and then essentially go conclusions. So the sliver, you really can multiply it concretely. I will not have time to go through this, but if you want to multiply states, you need to know the three-string vertex, and basically you need to know properties of this infinite dimensional matrices that sit here. There are three matrices that really matter, because these are have symmetry properties and cyclicity properties. And these three matrices are essentially the Neumann coefficients connecting the same strings and the ones connecting one with the string to the right and one with the string to the left. The three of them. And they're all well known. And their properties, which mostly the most that you need are these properties, were proven by Gross and Javicki many years ago. So, in fact, you can calculate, this was done by Kostelecki and Potting, the state that will square to itself, and now you work just in the matter sector, and you have to watch out normalizations and things like that, but basically it's a squeeze state with a matrix here S. And if you write S equals CT, where C is a matrix essentially of minus ones, and ones, I gave it here, there is a closed form expression for the matrix S, which is CT, and here it is, and the matrix X was the matrix of Neumann coefficients relating one string with one string. So basically, with that matrix of Neumann coefficients, you do this, and you find the state that multiplies to itself, algebraically. But since you have the picture of the sliver, you can actually calculate this directly, and we also calculated it directly and tested this numerically. This being infinite matrices, you can't quite do it so easily. So this is a closed form expression, but not a simple one. The picture of the sliver gives you a simple closed form expression. So there's two projector operators that are very useful to construct the products of things. And they essentially can be built with the matrices we have here, and they're complementary projectors operators, and have the interpretation of projectors to the left and to the right. And with them, you can learn to multiply all kinds of things, like Fock space states against slivers, slivers with oscillators with slivers, and essentially you can multiply many, many generic operators. Now, the sliver, as I was mentioning, the left side of the string is as far as possible from the right side of the string, and it was natural to believe that the wave function of the sliver is factorized. And indeed, you can take the sliver, find its wave function, and it looks like that, and then break the modes of the string into left modes of the left and modes of the right. That's relatively easy to do if you don't worry about the center of mass, which we don't need to worry because this is at zero momentum. And in this case, these matrices are known, and V is known or calculable because you know S, and you can test if this functional factorizes between left and right. And it just requires this property, which we didn't manage to prove, but we've checked numerically that the sliver state factorizes. And Gross and Taylor did prove factorization of a related form of the sliver. So the sliver does factorize, presumably, we're pretty confident of that, into left and right factors. And if you recall that matrix star multiplication is just like matrix multiplication of strings, that is, the functional of A star B is obtained by A on the left part, that's the left part of A becomes the left part of A times B, the right part of B becomes the right part of A times B, and the middle part is integrated over. If you see this, then the expression that the wave function of the sliver, the star of the sliver is the sliver itself, means that this F should be normalized to be equal to 1. And therefore, in the space of wave functions of half strings, wave functions just depend on half strings, the sliver acts as a rank 1 projector because it projects you into just F of X, which is the wave function of a half of the sliver state. K is just a matrix of numbers, which is calculable from the matrix S of the sliver. So this, actually, we don't know, we don't have any real good understanding of what the properties of this K is at this moment, but we can calculate it. So how do you act with a sliver on a wave function? You basically act by matrix multiplication, and since the sliver is factorized, this is always proportional to f of x, and it's therefore a projector. So this intuition tells you how to construct orthogonal projectors. You've seen that the sliver is now a projector, and you can take the matter part of the sliver as solving the matter part of the field equation. Since the ghost part we cannot solve, we leave it at that. And this matter part, we believe it represents a single D-brain. the deep brain of the boundary conformal field theory you used to write the string field theory you started with. Therefore, this sliver, matter sliver, would represent the classical solution, an exact classical solution of this form of string field theory, where you get now the solution of a deep brain. So you're seeing there in that coherent state e to the ASA, an exact classical solution. Now, to consider many deep brains, now you tie in into all these nice results of it's a solution of the the sliver. Well, the full equation, you still need to do more work because basically you have the other equation that needs to be solved is that Q on the ghost part of the string field equal to the ghost string field times ghost string field. And the total string field is the matter part times the ghost one. So if you take the sliver, our way of thinking at this moment is that the sliver, the real string field that solves the full equation, well, to solve the matter equation, you just take the matter part of the sliver. So we think the real string field would be the matter part of the sliver times some operator of ghost number one times the ghost part of the sliver. And that would have to be found yet to solve the second equation. So we've only solved the matter part of the equation. Yes, it definitely factorizes because it's essentially made out of pure Virasoro operator. So the sliver factorizes completely, and therefore it gives you states that multiply to themselves in both sectors, and you can use the matter part. And intuition suggests that if you're going to use the matter part of the sliver, the ghost part shouldn't be too different. So the claim is that the sliver does give you the matter part of the solutions and most likely a lot of the ghost part of the solution up to a ghost number one factor that still remains to be found. And this factor probably ties with the issue of finding what is the proper BRST operator, Q, that we didn't determine it. Once you understand that you got a projector of rank one, it's easy to construct other projectors. For example, another projector that you would need to represent now two coincident B-brains, you would need a projector orthogonal, another rank one projector that is orthogonal to your sliver. So that should be zero and should be a projector. If it's a projector, we also would believe it factors into two-way functions. And in order to get this projector and this to be orthogonal, the only thing you need is that G and F be zero and G be normalized. That's easy to achieve. If F, as it was even function of L, you define G, for example, to be an odd function of X times this even function, and then this integral is going to be zero. So just by inserting an X over here, you can produce an orthogonal projector, and you can also normalize it properly. Now, this might look a little hand-wavy, but there's a rigorous oscillator construction of all this. With the matrices that I showed you a few minutes ago, you can set the condition of a state chi, and you, since chi as a wave function has two x's, essentially the x left and the x right over here, as in addition from the sliver, you put two oscillators on the sliver and a constant that might be necessary, and the conditions of orthogonal projector and the BPZ inner product of the chi with itself being equal to the sliver with itself have a simple solution, it's easy to satisfy, and everything is tested explicitly. Therefore, this state, the sum of these two projectors into orthogonal spaces would be a rank two projector. Since the weight, the BPZ weight of this is the same as that, the BPZ weight of this sum is just equal to 2 times the BPZ weight of a single sliver. Therefore, it has twice the tension of a single sliver, and we believe is the 2D brains. Now, you can see that you can construct all kinds of projectors here, infinite number of them. If you would need to do infinite number of coincident D brains, you can construct related slivers that correspond to D brains of lower dimension, and many of them, and you can move them around and displace them by translation operators. We claim that actually this oscillator construction gives you essentially the general D brain configuration in flat space, that you can construct it. Nevertheless, I will not go through that, both for lack of time and because the description this afternoon by Ashok will be a little more geometrical and more general. So I want to go into a brief summary and then some speculations or open questions, rather. So we've discussed vacuum string field theory, and we've argued that it represents the Taakian vacuum, can be written explicitly using any boundary conformal field theory. And D brains are solutions where the matter and the ghost part of the string field factorize, and the matter equation is that of a projector. We have identified what seems to be the simplest well-defined projector in the star algebra, and it's the sliver. And it's a complete projector. If you just think of the matter and the ghosts at ghost number zero, then it's a perfectly good projector. It's well normalized, and it has it satisfies slivers times sliver equals sliver. Even though it arises as a singular limit, it's a well-defined state. In its original form, at least the matter part, and the ghost is still an open question, represents a D25 brain, but as will be discussed this afternoon, you can use it to describe any D brain. Well, the picture of the sliver suggested it was a wave functional that factors, and while this was not proven, at least by us, completely, the algebraic setup that is motivated by this observation is totally self-contained, so you can build your projectors precisely. So let me conclude with a little, not so little, but maybe I'll go through it fast. Open questions near and far future. They're not really terribly speculative, but I don't know if they really correspond to near or far future. Depends how lucky we get. So the most important question, I think it's clear, is that you have to fix the ghost sector of the theory. For example, Justin David has considered a particular set of operators, things that you can add to the sliver with ghost oscillators, and he found the beginnings of a candidate, numerical candidate for a D-brain solution, and did some tests of this. His operators correspond to, essentially in the picture, in the original picture of the sliver, to introducing a local ghost operator, say, in the boundary or near the other side of the sliver. These states are very peculiar in that if you wanted to figure out how do they look in Fock, in a Fock basis, they tend to diverge as n goes to infinity on the sliver, but nevertheless, they actually give you finite action. It's relatively simple to convince yourself that in the star product of three states like this, you will get a finite result. Gross and Taylor, as will be expressed tomorrow, have observed that in rather general circumstances, and we don't know how general, however, if you use regular Fock space states, apparently by the time you try to include the ghosts, you tend to get zero action. That's consistent with what David has found, that he did manage to find finite action, but using states that had funny limits. On the other hand, in the results of Gross and Taylor, the two kinds of BRST operators, whether they kill the identity or they don't kill the identity, are fairly different. So what's going to happen here? I think it seems quite likely that there's a way to produce a little unusual but tractable states of this kind. That's probably very likely to be the case. But nevertheless, we would definitely would like to do better. And there's some evidence that you can get to insert things on the sliver so that both the state is well defined and the action is well defined with carefully chosen insertion. So we don't quite think the result is clear yet. The nature of open string background independence, I think, is reasonably clear for marginal deformations. You can use any marginally related BCFT and the action will look the same. But it might be interesting to test for large deformations. So, for example, you write the vacuum string field theory using the D24 CFT and try to find the D25. And that should be possible. Now, closed strings are a problem, and they remain still a problem. Don't have too much, really, to say. I've written a lot, but don't have much to say, really. We more or less, I think most people agree on a certain kind of statement, that in conventional open string field theory, you do get closed string poles. This was found by these people in this. And it's, in principle, possible to extract closed string physics, but in practice, it's extremely hard. And you certainly need to do better if you're going to claim that you're going to describe closed strings with open strings. So presumably, the totally off-shell vacuum string field theory amplitude should show the closed string poles. But so far, at least, we didn't see any reason why we should get them there. Not very serious calculations have been attempted. It's interesting that a few days ago, Joe Minahan, who looked at the periodic string model, which in many ways is the best simple model that correlates to vacuum string field theory, and he looked at the tachyon at the bottom. There's no pole there. Nevertheless, loop corrections do generate a pole. It's a very massive state, but it's still a pole. On the other hand, the action for the tachyon in vacuum string field theory coincides with the periodic action for the tachyon, but there are more things. So somehow we might have to learn better how this pole arises or if it disappears in vacuum string field theory. Now, I think it's relatively clear that vacuum string field theory is closed string background dependent. This is not an ultimate closed string theory formulation that doesn't use a background or anything like that. You know, you find your D-brain solutions, you get them on tori, and certainly you would know from the mass of the excited states whether the torus is big or small. So I think it is clear that, as we said, we choose a CFT describing a closed string background, and you have a lot of freedom with a BCFT, but not with a CFT. So, of course, we choose a conventional closed string background. That's not to say that maybe someday we'll understand that there's also some sort of non-dynamical closed string background, but we don't have that yet. So the main question whether some of the closed string physics is incorporated in this string field theory, thanks Dan, I'm almost done, is that whether you can change the closed string background in this action without introducing closed string fields. This is the most speculative transparency I'm going to show. Since the sliver has a lot of bulk, the sliver, the local coordinate is here, and this is the bulk of the sliver, there's certainly lots of room to insert a closed string operator in there. And you could imagine that the state that you get over here when you integrate a closed string operator here would be quite different from any conventional state and could be somewhat strange. Perhaps anything like that might encode closed string physics. It's difficult to do that because whenever you insert a state in the bulk, you have divergences as you approach the boundary. So maybe there's a way to think of this as having some conformal field theory on the bulk and a different conformal field theory on the local coordinate. But anyway, this starts getting a little confusing, very confusing. And perhaps we're just saying there's a small possibility that this could be a kind of open string field that changes a closed string background. Or maybe it's nothing more than a byproduct, an open string byproduct of a closed string shift. It just adjusts the open string sector, as is familiar in Lightcon string field theory or in covariant open closed string field theory. You have explicit closed string fields, and when you shift the closed string field, you need a compensating open string field. So, and I'm almost done now, last transparency. So if the closed string background can be shifted via some state like that, well, we're in good shape. If it cannot, then we might need explicit closed string fields. And of course, we all know closed string theory is more complicated and life might be more complicated, but I, for once, would like someday to see a closed string field representing a black hole or a Neverschwarz 5 brain, so I don't think it's the end of the world. So final conclusions, due to the role of projectors in VSFT, one could anticipate that this subject that has always sort of come close to string theory, C-star algebras, von Neumann algebras, and now K-theory of C-star algebras and things like that, may be actually quite important in formulating precisely what open string field theory is. And I would think that this form of string field theory is not quite built all the way. The ghost sector is still missing, but many nice things have happened, and in particular, the way solitons arise, very similar to non-commutative solitons. As you will see this afternoon, there's some of the flexibility of this approach of boundary string field theory, and this theory has the precision of conventional open string field theory. The states are very well defined. So vacuum string field theory, if it's not quite it, is giving us at least a glimpse of some kind of formulation of string theory that is rather simple, and where Taakian physics and D-brains and multiple D-brains and multiple solitons certainly arise more easily than in you would do with multi-solitons in ordinary field theory. Thank you.
Thank you, Barton. Are there questions?
Can you foresee a chance that in the foreseeable future that can be related from, not in 25 dimensions, but in 3 dimensions of a physics laboratory to what we observe in reality?
Well, certainly nothing that I've said has any direct implication to physics in 4 dimensions. This is just a formulation of the theory to get started, and if it's the right formulation or in the right direction, it presumably will be useful someday to elaborate on those physics questions.
Greg?
You suggested a way of representing 2 D brains. There's another way, of course, of tensoring in the matrix algebra of n by n matrices. Are those supposed to be equivalent string fields somehow? And moreover, you could have, of course, added Chen Peyton factors and then asked whether there are other projectors which are not just tensor products.
Well, I think the tensor, the way you would say with Chan pattern factors would be the way it would look after you shift with this 2D brain solution. So the classical solution is the 2 projectors, and then the Chan pattern factors arise as the effective description once you obtain the 2 slivers. But we would not be able to generate a solution by just Chan patterning the original sliver.
Oh, really? You can't just tensor in the matrix algebra and get new solutions?
Sorry?
Yeah, but why not?
Yeah, the original string field didn't have it, but the...
Well, let me just tensor in a matrix algebra and rerun your theory. Why not?
Well, it sounds different. Now, the uniqueness of this action would perhaps suggest that that's really equivalent to not having the matrix algebra. It would be just some sort of overall factor after field with definitions, although I would not be able to see that directly yet.
I mean, if you start with a finite dimensional matrix algebra, you will only generate a finite number of dibrands this way. And you can never generate the number of dibrands which is above the dimension of the matrices. I mean, that corresponds to starting with a different theory. So you fix your theory once and for all, right, where you have the string field times an n by n matrix algebra, and then you can see what kind of solutions you can get, right? And so just by tensoring the sliver with matrix algebra, you'll get up to n dibrands. But if you want n plus 1 coincident dibrands, you still have to fall back to this option.
Any other questions? If not, let's thank